Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today we have the exciting part two episode of our interview with Forbidden Knowledge TV's Alexandra Bruce. Now, Alexandra's written some fascinating books on everything from the Montauk Project to the development of spiritualist movements in early America, but her latest subject matter may be her most compelling yet. Now, in part one, we concentrated on the deep state political research Alexandra's done at her website, ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.net. In this special episode, we'll explore the controversial topic of UFO technology and the dimensional doorways that may be opening as a result of experiments at CERN. We're in for a wild ride with this one. Here we go. Alexandra Bruce, UFOs and Alternative Timelines.
The scientific establishment is as rigid and intransigent as the Inquisition of the Middle Ages, where you must either profess your faith and conform to it, or lose your job. For thousands of years, mystical experience was universal and the norm, and these have been orphanized by scientific materialism.
You know, as some people are searching for reality beyond the official story, the media does their best to keep us distracted by chasing down idiotic stories of Pokemon fandom or celebrity wardrobe malfunctions. The road beyond the Matrix isn't going to be easy, which is why we need to create an environment where honest reporting can thrive. The problem with secrecy in an ostensibly open society is it creates a false reality for everyday people on the ground. Are we big enough to shape our own reality? Now, that's not a question I want to ask Amazon's Jeff Bezos, but let's go ask Forbidden Knowledge TV's Alexandra Bruce.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. And if that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lie.
Dark journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special summer discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist, let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Well, hello everyone. We're cruising through the summer here and it just gets stranger and stranger as the media is officially out of control on everything from the Trump candidacy to this unusual coup attempt in Turkey. That's why I'm so excited we have Forbidden Knowledge TV's Alexandra Bruce back with us today. And you'll recall in part one we discussed her extensive political research. In this one, we'll all see just how fantastic her work on UFOs and CERN and timelines is. Fascinating stuff, and remember to sign up for our newsletter at darkjournalist.com so you don't miss any of the shows coming up this summer. Alexandra, it's great to have you back for part two of our deep discussion.
It's great to be back. Good to see you again.
Now, when we left off in part one, you were discussing this UFO experience that you had in your teens in Brazil and how you eventually sought out the world-renowned UFO expert, Professor John Mack, over at Harvard University here in Cambridge. Now, can you tell us a little bit about what happened when you went to CMAC and what you learned from the experience?
Yes, so I guess we only talked in the last segment about my initial meeting with him and him determining that I would be a candidate for a regression. So then I guess a couple months later, I went back to Cambridge and I was regressed. And what that consisted of was lying down in his office, which was, it was actually in the Peer building. It was not on the Harvard campus, but very close. And with his assistant and a tape recorder, they tried to relax me.
So Dr. Mack was trying to bring you back to this early experience to see if there was anything there that he could uncover in terms of your memories.
Right.
So how did it go?
Well, my experience being regressed by Dr. John Mack at Harvard was that I was not hypnotizable. And it was sort of a letdown. I mean, I wanted to find something out, but I didn't go to that space where you hear, you know, you read about in that abductee literature where all this crazy information pops up in your head and suddenly you're there and all these things that you didn't remember happened. It didn't happen to me. But nothing
happened. So you felt there was something special about your experience there, but you didn't remember anything in particular beyond the strange sighting.
Right. I think there might even be something to my experience. I might even be an abductee, but whatever it is, I have not been taken to that level where I'm going to remember that. If it's true. Mac was incapable of taking me there.
Right.
So if it's true, I don't know. You know, there certainly are a lot of the earmarkings of the classic alien abduction phenomenon in my experience with my friend who went on to have more experiences where she ran into the shower when she saw a UFO with her baby and was hiding in the shower with her baby because she was terrified all of a sudden.
That is interesting because she was the girl who was there with you when you saw
that. The person who was with me, so you know, it kept happening to her later.
Right, so nothing happened with Mac, which must have been surprising and disappointing for you on some level. You know, you go to the top guy in the field for this kind of regression and there's no big breakthrough. So it left a big question mark there for you. But over the course of time now, since your early teen experiences, you've also had other UFO sightings, right?
And I've never had one as intense as that one. Uh-huh. But I have seen every shape, size, type of movement, you know, out there. That first one was very weird because it definitely did not seem alien at all. It seemed man-made. It seemed, like I said, the first thing that I said was it's the Americans. And I said, or it's the Russians, you know, because we were in Brazil and it was the Cold War back then. So it was one of the superpowers is what I assumed, because there was just absolutely nothing weird or alien about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, it looked like it was FCC and FAA approved red lights for radio towers, stuff on it, you know?
Yeah, it definitely sounds unusual. Now, with your own experiences of these sightings, it definitely gives you a greater insight into reporting on this kind of thing. On ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.net, for example. In fact, it's a regular feature up there. And we can see everything from classic UFO stuff from the 90s to totally modern UFO videos. So I guess my question is, you know, you've seen people describe these encounter experiences over and over again. What do you think is really happening there?
I think part of it could be human beings in the future coming back to mine our genetics and reincorporate them back in because they had a nuclear war or something, or whatever. I think part of it could be other, you know, possible genetic relatives of ours in the galaxy or you know, the universe, multiverse. And I think a great deal of them are MyLabs, are staged, with hypnosis, and apparently, you know, the technology is apparently incredibly advanced.
And just to clarify that, a MyLab is a kind of acronym for military abduction.
Yes, a MyLab is a military abduction, and apparently the technology is so advanced that it can simulate in the mind of the experiencer an event that seems just completely real.
Right.
And it mimics the classic alien abduction scenario. And it is done to propound an agenda about aliens you know, a message about aliens to the human population that the deep state wants to propound.
Right, exactly. Now, let's look at what you think would be a legitimate UFO abduction case.
A legitimate case?
Well, is there one that stands out for you that you find very compelling?
I think the Betty and Barney Hill story sounds quite legitimate, uh-huh. And that's why it stands the test of time, and it's sort of a, you know, this it is the cornerstone, it is of the UFO era, you know, the alien abduction motif or whatever. It is the first and in many ways the least contaminated. It's the least contaminated case because it was the first. They weren't imitating anybody. They weren't trying to please their therapist. They were just trying to get their lives back together. So I think it remains a very interesting case. It's worthy of anybody's study.
I definitely agree with you. That case still sets the standard for authenticity. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, what would make a good MyLab or simulated abduction case?
A really good case, and it's explained very well by Dr. Stephen Greer, of a MyLab, is the one that was published in Bud Hopkins' book, Witnessed, where Linda Cortile was observed by several people driving on the Brooklyn Bridge, people driving on the FDR Expressway, people driving under the FDR, people walking around in Lower Manhattan, saw her being levitated out of her window and floated up into a UFO, and she herself had that memory. And then she went on to write her own book that was bizarre, you know, about those two FBI agents who reported the events but then disappeared and so actually did not provide the real solid backup that Bud Hopkins actually needed to publish that story as with the kind of integrity that he needed.
Right. And I know that this case actually involved a UN ambassador, so people like Mack and Hopkins took a special interest in it. What was it that was going on there exactly?
It was a MyLab that was staged and was experienced by dozens of people. That they somehow created a field that could affect, that could impinge on into the brains of people driving on the Brooklyn Bridge, driving on the FDR Expressway, driving underneath the FDR, walking around Lower Manhattan near her apartment. They saw her being floated out of a window and floated into a UFO. She reported having this experience and contacted him. And Boutros Ghali was aware of this experience,
right.
And apparently so was a Prince of Luxembourg, who, as a result of this, the way this MyLab scenario was propagated, it actually, according to Stephen Greer, stopped the disclosure of extraterrestrial reality from happening back then, which was roughly 1994 or so.
I think this is a major case, and it's interesting you mentioned Stephen Greer in there because, of course, he set up the important National Press Club events with former astronauts and retired military personnel discussing in depth their knowledge about UFOs. He later went on to form the Disclosure Project. And now some of his critics say that he has this idea of benevolent ETs visiting Earth and that the harsh stuff like abductions is all the work of the military. What do you think of that? Is he being naive?
He's certainly seen enough material to make qualified statements like that. But personally, I think that that just might be his own experience. I don't know why he would turn his back on those stories. I'm sure he must be aware of them.
Well, I think you're making an excellent point here, which is so much around this phenomena has to do with your own perspective looking at it. I know in some religious circles, for example, they see the opposite going on. So UFOs are fallen angels, etc. And I find that kind of particularly interesting since so many early spiritual texts really do seem to reference UFOs and hardly in a negative light. So it is really how you see it that makes the difference here.
Right.
Now, one last thing on the UFO question before we move on is, as someone who studied it for many years, where do you think we are now in terms of understanding it? you know, for example, starting this year, there's been a strange push to bring it into the public eye again, from presidential candidate Hillary Clinton talking about it on late night talk shows to Pepsi making these 10-minute commercials about the Anunnaki and the Black Knight satellite. Pretty strange trends if you think about it. So are we seeing a new wave of interest? You know, it seems that this is the most attention it's received in the mainstream world since maybe the year 2000 and the aftermath of the Phoenix Lights incident. So, you know, after that, 9/11 seemed to shut off any advances in the discussion around UFOs. But what do you think is going on here in 2016?
I think that they'll probably only cop to the existence of extraterrestrials and their technology, but not the abduction part, because that'll open them up to the kind of liability that I was talking about before that would wipe out an entire nation or something if people sued
right.
the government. So I think it's probably in the interest of, although the military-industrial complex loves having all these wars and maintaining the hydrocarbon status quo, ultimately, I think even these greedy bastards know that that's not sustainable and that they want to have the monopoly on whatever's next technologically. And so that's how it's going to be rolled out. Whatever, you know, extraterrestrial technology or whatever, maybe interdimensional, whatever you want to call it, advanced technology that's going to be rolled out, will be rolled out in a controlled fashion such that these same entities that are in charge of the petroleum cartels will have the patents and the control over, you know, the new energy paradigm so that they can still make money.
So you think the UFO issue is largely an energy issue, which is why it may have to become disclosed at some point?
I think the big reason why it hasn't been exposed is because it's an energy issue, because we're talking about how in the world do these things get here from, how do they go faster than light, basically. It would put the hydrocarbon industry out of business, and that would mean our whole civilization would collapse. So it has to be done in a controlled fashion so that we don't have a total collapse of jobs and infrastructure, you know, sort of like what the internet has done, but it like a million times more, you know what I'm saying? What the internet has done to so many businesses by crashing them, you know, it's not the intent of the internet to do that, and it's not the intent of an advanced technology to crash anything, but that is the effect.
But we do have UFO activists and people who've deeply studied it for years saying, well, it's 70 years later. By now, they should have been able to roll it out. It seems like it's been kept behind a wall of secrecy, and a small group has just been reaping all of the benefits.
Right. They're hoarding it for themselves, and the military-industrial complex is milking the Wehrmacht and the war machine and war profiteering for as much as they can. And that's really what's been going on there.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And maybe there'll be a time, maybe after they've genocided enough of us or whatever, that it'll be time to roll out the new technology. I don't know.
So you think that at some point they'll actually let this exotic technology out?
I think, yeah.
That would change a 70-year policy.
But I think it would probably eradicate a lot of incredible profit-taking that goes on, too, at the same time. And that's precisely what the energy cartels don't want to see. They want to maintain the monopoly that they have.
So some of them really will do anything to prevent it, but at a certain point they'll have to roll it out because the traditional energy model is just going down fast. So my question for you on this is the UFO the missing piece to history?
Yeah, on a lot of levels.
What is the most crucial level?
Potentially our own origins and the fact that it still takes exactly the same amount of time to fly from New York to Rio as it did 50 years ago, or more, 60. It's ridiculous.
So we're in a backward spiral here.
Yeah, I mean, we're being retarded. Our technological development, while it seems like we got all these gizmos with the computers, when it comes to transportation and energy, you know, just energy generation in general, we are absolutely being retarded and suppressed. And I ran recently a really interesting clip that was from Stephen Greer, that Stephen Greer's people had interviewed Paul LaViolette, the physicist, and he was talking about having read a think tank report from 1956 in England, and I'm forgetting the name of the think tank, but they were basically, they were in conversations with all of the top aviation manufacturers in the world, obviously most of them in the United States, including all the military ones, and Boeing and Lockheed, and there were about 15 that were named that they said had the capability, the infrastructure, to implement a back-engineered propulsion system that was based on masers, which is focused microwaves. And the way that Paul LaViolette describes this anti-gravity technology is that these beams almost act like the legs of a chair or a table. They push down and they cause the thing to levitate. The beams themselves and the nature of masers is that they don't scatter. They really stay focused. So it really is like almost like a solid object. And apparently the TRB-3s, the black triangles that a lot of people report, that are many people also allege are of human manufacture, of U.S. military or whatever, New World Order manufacture, whatever it is, mm-hmm. whoever's making this stuff are human beings. And it's back-engineered alien technology using maser anti-gravity propulsion. And we had this. This existed. We had it in the mid-50s, ready to go and ready to actually launch and be able to travel much faster than we do using jets.
That is fascinating. Now, one of the categories you have on the Forbidden Knowledge TV site is the Secret Space Program. Of course, we did the conference last year in Texas, and we're joined by former Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz and Linda Moulton Howe. And I know you've run a number of key videos on the subject and really been an early adopter of the whole thing. Now, something of a trend has been happening lately with people claiming to be whistleblowers, you know, saying, I'm Captain So-and-so and I was in the Secret Space Program. On the other hand, we've had legitimate players like Gary McKinnon, and who was the NASA hacker, who saw an off-world officers list in their computers, mm-hmm. which suggested an entire program that was operating in outer space that the public has no knowledge of. Now, what do you think is happening at this point? Are they trying to discredit this story by putting forward these imaginary whistleblowers? You know, before the imitators came along, there have been some truly brave people trying in one way or another to tell us something about this clandestine program.
I think that the people who are willing to speak to it basically are people who are on death's doorstep and don't care if the government kills them anymore at this point, and they want to tell the truth.
Right. So around this topic generally, people like the late Colonel Philip Corso, who said we re-engineered alien technology that we'd obtained in crash retrievals to make major advances, and a Lockheed Skunk Works CEO, Ben Rich, who developed the stealth fighter and said on his deathbed that we already had the means to travel among the stars, but the knowledge was locked up in black projects.
So there are, I'm sure, many still in the can waiting for these guys to kick the can
right.
and to come out, because that's the only way. These people, they gave an oath that where their lives would be terminated if they shared this information. And so that's the deal there.
Right. So do you think that along with these brave truth tellers, we're seeing these caricatures coming out left and right who are saying, I was part of the Secret Space Program, etc.? Is that disinformation that's just set out there to delude these true confessions?
Well, I think that, there are some characters. It reminds me of the Montauk Project stuff, these Me Too people, these copycat people. And it could be literally that you step into a field, a reality field, and you resonate with it and you and maybe it's a parallel universe thing, and somehow you feel like you're an experiencer of that reality. That might be a component to it.
Okay, so you're saying maybe there are people out there who just over-identify with the topic to such a point that they start sharing their impressions that they're getting.
Yeah.
And that's more of a process in their psyche versus an actual experiencer.
Right. I think some guys have more evidence documentation than others. I wrote a book about Phil Schneider, and his wife gave me like a suitcase-sized amount of documentation that showed that he did work in the building of many, many underground, deep underground bases, and that he had face-to-face experience with tall, big-nosed grays, as he described them, and that was an interesting case. That was the first book I ever wrote. I was commissioned to write it by Peter Moon, the publisher of Sky Books and of the Montauk Project book series. And it was really a hair-raising experience to get involved with that whole world of information, because it sucked you in. And it was all, you know, suddenly you began to see and experience and taste and feel the whole thing.
This is a really intriguing process you're describing, and I do think that kind of deep reporting pays off. Now, with Phil Schneider, he was a major whistleblower who claimed he worked on these deep underground bases long before anyone else came along and described them. He was killed in a pretty horrible way after he came out with his story. And actually, the name of your first book, which is excellent, is called The Philadelphia Experiment Murder. And Schneider is the murderer. So it's your investigation of his death. Now, what was he saying that they decided he just needed to be eliminated?
Well, he was describing the names and locations and the nature of all of these deep underground bases that he'd been working on for so many years. And that those are big secrets, and people didn't want him talking about it. His murder was covered up by the Multnomah, Oregon County coroner. They didn't even do a real exam of him. He was pretty much bedridden, and he had a catheter, you know, to urinate, and that catheter, the rubber tube, was found. He basically, that was the cause of death, according to the coroner, was self-asphyxiation. And when I asked the head of the New York City narcotics squad if that was a way that people could die, was by self-asphyxiation, he said no, because you'd pass out before you died. And then I said, I'll tell you the whole story, how they found him. Okay, so he apparently self-asphyxiated and then fell face forward onto his wheelchair, hit his head on the wheelchair, and then onto the ground, and then blood spilled out of his mouth. And he said, no, because if he were dead, blood wouldn't be pumping anymore, and blood wouldn't be coming out of his mouth at that point. So there's a lot of things wrong in this coroner's report.
Now, what I've always found fascinating about Schneider is that he's tied to several major stories in alternative research. The most fantastic one is the Dulce Wars, which is basically that while he was drilling for this underground base in Dulce, they encountered a stranger underground base where alien human experiments were going on. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Apparently, while he was expanding the base, the human Earth base, the military base, it blew into a pre-existing alien underground base that had been there for quite some time. And the description was that it smelled like the worst. It smelled so bad, it was unbelievable. And it was full of these tall, big-nosed grays. And they immediately got into a skirmish. You know, they had just blown a hole in their wall, and the aliens are mad, and they think they're being attacked. The humans are freaking out. They didn't expect them to be there. And he said people died. I forgot the amount. And that he was shot at. I think he said that the gray just sort of waved his hand at him. And he said it just cut me open like a fish. It just cut open his whole abdomen.
Whoa.
And he was in a basket. It wasn't an elevator. He was in a basket. that, you know, because they were just still, it was raw, a raw space that they were blowing up. And he said that this, a soldier was able to get him into the basket, and that basket was hoisted up, but the soldier actually died. The guy who saved his life died.
Now, Schneider, as it turns out, actually had legitimate credentials that you saw.
I saw his tax reports from Morrison Knudsen, his wife, his ex-wife of several years, just described all the scars, the scar from that event, this huge thing that went up and down his abdomen, similar to that guy that Jim Mars maybe had, which might be interesting.
Richard Thielman.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting about that is Schneider, like I said, is tied to these other stories. His family tracks back. His dad was a paperclip Nazi. That's also in your book. Now, how do you feel it plays into all this, and do you think it's true?
Well, I mean, there's not a lot of proof of it, but apparently he was captured from a sub, and actually because of his, I guess he had really good medical skills, because that's what he became, was the chief medical officer of the Navy. That was his position. And he was in charge of the medical experiments, the medical part of the Bikini Atoll atomic tests. He was the guy who tested the effects of that kind of radiation on the human body.
That is intriguing. And here we are again with that paperclip Nazi trail showing up in these exotic scenarios. You know, we have UFO technology and underground bases. Definitely connections here. And Schneider was a kind of living proof before he was removed from the scene. You did extensive work on Schneider's story. What is your final impression of the whole thing?
Well, that essentially what he was saying was true, and that he was murdered, and the murder was covered up. And that these programs, I think, tend to be multi-generational in nature. They tend to choose from the children, you know, the children of guys who are already involved.
So just being the son of a paperclip Nazi, he was going to have an unusual line of work,
yeah,
and a strange destiny.
Right.
Yeah.
It just makes it easier to keep the secrets that way. It's a family thing, you know.
Absolutely. Well, you did some incredible deep research on him and the story he was trying to tell us. I don't think people yet comprehend exactly what he was trying to get across about a whole different infrastructure existing underground. But little by little, his descriptions of these vast construction projects in the 90s, it seems so much more plausible now when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
With all that in mind, we're going to plunge in further to the mystical places of your writing and analysis. This time, it's the strange case of the Montauk Project and some of the new work you're looking at with the CERN Hadron Collider. This is getting hardcore. Last round here, coming up with Forbidden Knowledge TV's Alexandra Bruce. Stay with us.
Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Subscribe now and you'll have access to the complete audio archives to download or stream at your convenience. Receive advanced updates and discounts on Dark Journalist events. Enjoy exclusive subscriber-only content. Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special summer discount. Available for just $39 for one full year. Dark Journalist. The truth is never easy.
They were sitting there filming, a little saucer came from, came flying over their heads, put down three little landing gear and landed right out on the dry lake bed. And they picked up their cameras and started over toward it, filming as they went. And when they got in fairly close to it, it lifted up, put the gear back in the wheel wells, tipped up, and took off at a great rate of speed.
Dark Journalist will go there.
The problem with secrecy in an ostensibly open society is it creates a false reality.
Hidden technology.
So in other words, the possibility exists that you have here a machine that is manipulating magnetic fields on a planetary scale that has nothing to do with particle physics.
The black budget.
But there's no such thing as getting away from the corruption, because it is literally... it is now integrated into every economy in the globe.
Geoengineering.
I'm talking about
right down to the DNA level. Imagine that you have now put microprocessors and sensors, along with everything else, into every human body.
For more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries, visit darkjournalist.com today. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
And we are back. This is Dark Journalist, and I'm speaking with the author, Alexandra Bruce. Alexandra's website is an open source video showcase that's showing videos on subjects ranging from holistic health to UFOs and deep politics. It's at ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.net. Go check it out. You might never leave with all the fascinating content there. And of course, you can find part one of our interview at darkjournalist.com. Now, Alexandra, your research has taken you some really interesting places, and I find the jump from the Philadelphia experiment to the Montauk Project was just crucial. The inside man on the Philadelphia experiment was Bob Beckwith. Now, can you tell us about him?
He was a kid. He was a wunderkind, and at 23, he developed a system for time-tripped telemetry that enabled the power that was being generated by the nuclear plant there to go further than it had ever gone before.
Interesting. All right.
And so he was just this brain, and now he was working at Bell Labs after that job, and the Navy commandeered him to work on sonar projects.
Now, did you speak to him personally?
Yes.
And what did you think of him?
I think that maybe he was as cagey about me as I was about him, you know. I don't think that he was a liar.
Okay.
This was a guy who had a straight-up business, and that's a family business, and is a very successful business, too. You know?
So according to what he told you, the Philadelphia experiment was real. The only difference was that it happened in Rhode Island, and then the ship and crew found themselves far away in Philadelphia.
Yeah. And it was a totally different boat.
Wow.
And the only thing he could remember was the hull number, which was IX-97. And so I had a friend who knew more about Navy stuff. And I had a full-time job anyway. But so he went to the library. And the book wasn't in Southampton Library, but it was in Patchogue Library. And he had it loaned to Southampton. There was a picture of it, which then I made a big Xerox of it. And it's in my book.
Excellent.
And this was the boat that he said, and I found out the whole history of that boat. It had been a private yacht owned by a Connecticut millionaire, and then it was outfitted with experimental equipment and rechristened the USS Martha's Vineyard. And I think the hull designation IX means experimental.
Mm-hmm.
And it was used for several years, and then it was decommissioned and returned to its owner after the war.
Wow, really interesting history there. So the implications are that at the time, we possessed the technology to make something invisible.
Right, and then he described this equipment in the aft part of the boat, on the back deck, that he said was like the size of a refrigerator, and he says that he had been told that it emitted like three counter-rotating fields that he believed, that he theorized, based on his knowledge as an electronic engineer, that maybe they were creating what he called divided space. Like they were able to separate a certain space from universal space, as he calls it, to decouple a certain space, to delocalize it. And that this was a thing that was being looked at as a way to evade attacks, is that you'd be 1 second ahead, you'd be invisible because you wouldn't be in the timeline.
I see.
And then he said later, years later, he went on a tour of what was then the new Osprey class of minesweepers. And the guys who were giving him the tour seemed to be quite upfront and honest about the fact that it had time-traveling abilities, that it had the ability to be 1 second ahead or, you know, off of universal time. And that's where it got its invisibility from, not from any shielding or invisibility cloak or cloaking effect, but by actually not by being a step outside of universal time.
Oh, it's definitely intriguing. Now, you ran across this topic of time travel again in your investigation of the Montauk Project.
Yes.
When you were encountering these really kind of young people who had been involved, they said, with this unusual experiment.
They were, one was 19 and one was 23, and they were being deprogrammed by Preston Nichols.
Right, and Nichols is an unusual character, claimed he was the electrical engineer for these experiments. And basically, the Montauk Project was said to be a series of time travel experiments at Montauk Air Force Base there on Long Island.
Right, and Preston was trying to drill down and find out basically what the deep state was doing, was up to, what they were doing with these kids and what they were preparing them for. And
so you interviewed them.
I interviewed both of them, and they both said that they were involved with craft retrievals, fallen UFO retrievals, for many years, starting at a very young age. Like by the age of 12, they were knew how to secure places and cut them off and command people to, you know, get them on a flatbed and get them out of there.
Interesting.
They were like physically strong guys, right? They were actually, both of them were quite small.
So they were part of a crash retrieval team for UFOs.
Mm-hmm. That's what they said.
Wow. Now, how did they strike you when you spoke to them? Did you get the feeling they were involved in a deep black project?
Well, the 19-year-old really freaked me out because he said, I'm not really this person. I was a commander. I was a lieutenant in Vietnam, and they put me in this body. This is not really my original body. And he really talked and acted like an older guy, and it was bizarre.
Yeah.
And then they also said that they were being trained for a war in the desert. So I was interviewing them in 1996 and 1997, and they said that they were being prepared for a war in the desert with aliens in 2003.
That's so far out.
And so then when we invaded Iraq in 2003, I couldn't help but recall those statements that they had made and wonder if there was something to that.
Well, just that part is amazing, that they predicted this war coming in 2003.
I know. And, well, the thing is that, see, 2003 is a resonant year in the biorhythm of the Earth. The Philadelphia experiment happened in 1943, and 2000, every 20 years is part of the Earth's biorhythm. Every 20 years is a resonant year with that year, and so that's why 1983 was when the Montauk Project happened, and which meant the end of the Montauk Project, really, which was not one project. It was many projects. It looked like it was all kinds of genetic engineering stuff, out-of-body remote viewing stuff, and astral projection and physical projection using the super collider at Brookhaven.
That is fascinating. And one of the remarkable features of the Montauk story is the so-called psychic chair, where they would use a psychic relaxing in a chair to create an energy field to facilitate time travel.
That was apparently using a chair from a UFO, and they would have a psychic in this case, most of the cases, Duncan Cameron, who had been very trained to really dial into specific places and times, and that he would be in this chair, which is very responsive to conscious focus, because apparently that's how some UFOs are driven, is they're driven by the pilot, is purely with their mind. I've even heard crazier stories that some of these UFOs actually have DNA. They have the same DNA as the pilot.
Oh, that's intriguing. But the super collider aspect being used to enhance astral projection, what did you think when they fired up the Hadron Collider at CERN? That must have sent all kinds of bells going off.
This is why when I started hearing about CERN, I began to wonder if there might be a time travel or interdimensional component
right.
to CERN. And then it even is publicly acknowledged that there is an interdimensional component to CERN, but the one that's being made public, I don't think is the real one. I can't claim to know what they're doing at CERN, but all I know is that I have to say that so many things that I read in Montauk books, I would see 5 years later on the headlines of the New York Times, like how AT&T laundered Nazi gold bars. There it was, you know, he said it, and then it was on the front page in 1997. You know, I heard it a few years before, and then there it was on the front page that they laundered the money from Nazi gold bars to build out Spain's telecom, their whole phone network, ITT Corporation, who he said were big time involved with the Montauk Project.
Okay, so let's go really far out on this for a second. In my interviews with Dr. Joseph Farrell, he's talked about one of the hidden purposes of the CERN-Hadron Collider being to communicate with other dimensions. And you've done some research on alternative timelines, which ties to some of the work around the Philadelphia Experiment and the Montauk Project that you've done. So I guess now you had some sources saying that they were transferring things like weapons and gold to this alternate dimension and using it as a means of transfer. This is edgy stuff. What exactly was going on there?
Well, actually, I was having dreams that were so real. This is when my I'm not an abductee thing begins to fall apart, because then I started to have direct dreams of knowing that this was happening, that they were hiding munitions, that they were hiding troops, they were hiding all kinds of things in parallel universes. And also, at the time, I was, because I was spending a lot of time with Glenn Pruitt, who I met in a New Age venue, and he was claiming to be an Atlantean crystal healer guy or whatever, but he was somehow we became friends. I would not normally become friends with someone like that.
But his dad was Jay Pruitt.
His father was everybody says he was the director of the Montauk Project, who was in charge of hiring, firing, and paying personnel. Mm-hmm. And Glenn hated that. He didn't want to hear this story. And then he confronted people like Preston and others with a group shot of his father with 20 other people. It was his father at his job at Republic Bank of New York's insurance division in Dallas, Texas. And he said, pick my father out of this crowd, and all of them picked him out immediately. And so then he began to realize that there had to be something to the story. And then when he started to go into it as this amazing psychic person who weighed 1,000 pounds, I mean, he was the most over-the-top human being I've ever met in my life. He was the most intelligent, most psychic, and by far the biggest person I've ever met.
And some of the things he told you, and of course, here we are again with these family connections, you know, here with Pruitt and his dad, and earlier with Schneider and his father. But he told you that essentially this alternate timeline dimension idea was, in fact, correct.
And what he was saying were things that were crazy. He was saying that that there were parallel universes to ours that were just slightly off, you know, where the Nazis had won World War II, and it was a really regressive and aggressive timeline, and that it was trying to colonize our timeline and make what happened in their timeline true in our timeline.
Wow.
And what has been amazing.
Whoa, what's going on there?
What?
Uh-oh, I lost your sound, so we got scrambled. Now that was a total electronic funk.
How do I know?
Did you notice it?
Yeah. So I'm getting into serious, crazy shit now.
Right, exactly. Well, I'm going to leave it in there, because the whole system's getting funky now, so let's just keep rolling.
So, okay, so these were, he talked about timelines that were almost the same as our own, except for that the Nazis had won World War II. Some would say that they did, except for that it's just underground and it's the deep state of the United States. That's
right.
What Jim Marr's book says, Fourth Reich. I agree with that statement. But this is in an overt way the Nazis won World War II, and that they were trying to make, and of course it had to do with alien involvement also, and that they were trying to make this very fascist, super state, global, New World Order reality true in this timeline.
Huh.
And what was amazing, you know, hearing this in 1996, it just sounded like crazy talk, like, oh yeah, good luck or whatever, but Now, in 2016, it's like, oh my God, it's like almost done, you know?
Right. Good luck. It is amazing the track that we find ourselves on currently. So let's boil down this idea now, this concept of colonizing timelines. Now, the Hadron Collider at CERN is ostensibly there to smash particles together so scientists can observe this process and discover the God particle or Higgs boson. You know, this is something they claim they've already discovered, but there's some dispute about that. We've also heard some weird issues about these strangelets, which are a potential byproduct of these experiments, which some scientists warned about and said they would be released. And some of them even filed court orders to stop CERN from doing this with the collider. But this is what I want you to thread together for us now. How does the colonizing of timelines, the CERN Hadron Collider, and the UFO factor in together?
Well, these extraterrestrial groups aren't stuck in our third dimensional time track. They can go in and out. They can insert things into our history and make the present different. Apparently, they do it all the time, according to all these Montauk people I met. And so that would be, so as far as time travel and interdimensional stuff, alien involvement, and what CERN is doing with interdimensional and timelines and whatnot would seem like a perfect combination. And that's why it was also allegedly present at Montauk, because they were doing the same thing.
So are we trying then to access their reality by going through something like the Hadron Collider to communicate with alternate dimensions? Is that the main thing?
Yeah, but I think what people talk more about, I don't know what they're doing, okay? I mean, I have to first qualify anything I say by saying I don't know. But what more people seem to be concerned about is that they are more like opening our timeline up to their end.
I see.
And in fact,
making it easier to come through.
That was something that was also alleged in the Philadelphia experiment, that it was that brought in this whole wave, this whole flap of UFOs of the 20th century.
So it's a dimensional doorway.
Yes.
Absolutely. Fascinating stuff. Alexandra, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing this deeper level of your work. I know you don't do this very often, and I really appreciate it. And of course, you know, I can't wait for your next book. But people in the meantime can see what you're up to at ForbiddenKnowledgeTV.net. And of course, you're rolling out the new version of the site in the fall.
Oh, sooner than that, I think. I think it'll be within a month. I'll have a very zippy, cool new site. It'll be a work in progress for a while. But it'll be much bigger, better, faster, stronger, everything.
Well, it sounds great, and the site really has excellent videos and those fantastic essays that you write up there. So, Alexandra, thanks again for being here with us, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always great.
Anytime. Have a great one. Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode on UFOs and alternative timelines with Forbidden Knowledge TV's Alexandra Bruce. You can find more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Tune in next week when Dark Journalist welcomes UFO abduction expert Dr. David Jacobs. Subscribe to our newsletter at darkjournalist.com to stay updated on the latest shows.